Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Wealth DNA with Ron the Ronald Naraki. It's time to check your Wealth DNA so you can enjoy the second half of life. Here's the host of the show, Ron Naraki.
Well, hello world. Welcome to the Christmas edition of the Wealth DNA radio show. Today is December 27th, 2010. It's 8 o'clock in the morning in almost sunny Arizona. The sun's just coming out here and sneaking through the clouds. I'm your host, Ron Naraki. If you didn't receive an email reminding you about this show, just send an email to me, and that's ron@theronald.us, and we'll keep you posted about future shows and events. Feel free to use that email to make comments, ask questions offline, or suggest topics you want us to cover. One of those events will be a live seminar, Learn to Earn a Higher Return. The next seminar is Tuesday, January 11th at 10:15 a.m. They are held at Entrust Arizona's Knowledge Center right here in Phoenix. It's on the north side of Phoenix. And I will be sending out that exact address. Make sure you just stay in tune to our emails. Many people think that Christmas started sometime in November and ended on December 25th, but no, it didn't. December 25th was actually the first day of Christmas. So today is the third day of Christmas, and after today, we still have 9 days left in this wonderful holiday season. People wonder, well, why 12 days? And think back, 2,000 years ago, it took the wise men 12 days to travel to find the little baby in a manger. You see, national airlines like Southwest Airlines and US Air, United, or over there, LL, which would be the national airline likely to take you to Jerusalem today, they weren't around. That was actually 19 centuries prior to airline travel, so travel by camel, donkey, and on foot was a little slower back then. Today we could get there in a matter of a day. Now, back then it was a lot longer trip. By the way, today's show is live. It is not pre-recorded, so we welcome you to ask questions. You can either do that via the chat room by clicking on that green button you see on the screen, or call in. On the number is 917-388-4162. Again, let me repeat that. The call-in number is 917-388-4162, and our producer and host, Pete the Boomer, will bring you on to ask your question. Today we're going to focus on the D in Wealth DNA. Now, some of the listeners are probably not as familiar with the Wealth DNA framework yet. DNA stand for the three major obstacles that hold back 95% of people from becoming wealthy. The D stands for desire. If we conduct a survey, most people would say they really do want to become wealthy. But the reality is our subconscious has been programmed to not become wealthy. Yep, to stop us. Rather than me providing some of the key reasons why I know this is true, we have a very special guest today joining us who will do a lot better job than I can. Now, how can I be so sure that this guest will do a great job of explaining this? Well, our guest today is Dr. Michael Carlton. Dr. Carlton is an internal medicine physician based right here in Scottsdale, which, for those of you not familiar with the Phoenix area, most people consider Scottsdale a sister city to Phoenix rather than a suburb. Either way, it's right next door to Phoenix itself. He is an expert on substance abuse, dependency, addictions, and most importantly, breaking the power of those addictions over you. I met him several years ago as the author of The Addiction to Poverty. Let me repeat that, Addiction to Poverty. You see, in addition to his practice, he's also a public speaker who shares the stage with investment gurus like Robert Kiyosaki. And I actually saw him at one of those sessions with Mr. Kiyosaki and made a huge, huge impact on me. Well, more than an impact, I would say Dr. Carlton is the person I credit for planting the seeds of this whole wealth DNA concept. So rather than telling you more, let me have him tell you a little bit about his background. Let's give a warm radio welcome to Dr. Michael Carlton. Welcome.
Thank you, Ron. How are you today?
Excellent, excellent. And hopefully you're going to enjoy this third day of Christmas as much as I do. We don't give up easily here on such a great season. A little bit of relaxing, a little bit of planning. But let's start talking a little bit about your practice. I mentioned a little bit about you, but tell us in your words a little bit about your practice, what you do to help people, what your mission is in helping them break that power over the addictions.
Sure. We have a couple of offices around the Phoenix Valley, and there's a number of doctors who are here, but our real goal is to help people find within themselves the real answer to their problems. What we know is that everything I need and you need and everyone else needs is already right there. The seeds are there. It's in our DNA. And what we need to do is try to figure out a way to activate that. You know, Einstein once said you can't solve a problem with the same mind that created it. And while that's true, it's actually possible to change your mind. It's not easy to change your mind. And like you had pointed out, sometimes we say on the outside, we really want something, but on the inside, it really holds us back. I'm reminded of a story where a man went up to a great pianist, and the guy said, "You know, I would love to play piano like you." And the musician said, "No, you wouldn't." He goes, "No, you don't understand. I would just love to play piano." He goes, "No, you wouldn't." He goes, "I would do anything." He goes, "No, you wouldn't." He goes, "Why? Why do you keep saying that?" And the musician said, "Because if that's what you really would love to do, you would be doing it.
Right.
If you love to do it like me, you wouldn't be telling other people you love to do it. You would simply be doing it." And that's what we need to try to do. And that's what we do in our offices, is help people find a way within themselves, within the talents and the gifts that they have, to do what they say they really want to do. Help them to break that cycle. And really, that is in the DNA. I mean, what we know is that we inherit genes, and we know that there are genes for personality. We know that there are genes for hair color. We know that there are genes for eye color. But we also know there are genes for behaviors. And many of those behaviors are there. And unlocking the secret to that is really important. Because simply because you have the genes for it doesn't mean you're doomed to it. A simple example of that is if you look at Alzheimer's disease. 80% of people with the genetics for Alzheimer's disease will never get Alzheimer's. So just because I have the genes for something, most people with addictions, there are 5 genes that we've already found that will increase your risk of becoming an alcoholic. There are several that will increase your risk of becoming dependent on opiates or cocaine or amphetamine. But simply having those genes is not enough. Those genes have to then be turned on and activated. And any gene that can be turned on can also be turned off. And that's what we really want to do. We really want to help people find the keys for their problems so that they can turn the genes off that we want to switch out, and we can activate the ones that really are there.
Cool. And your central focus is helping people with addictions. You touched on the example of the Alzheimer's, and boy, that would be a topic in itself, especially as more and more people reach our baby boomers and reach the age of worrying about those things. But your central focus is addictions, as I understand.
Our focus is addiction, and even within the addiction community, we primarily focus on people with chemical addictions. So, meaning that people who have problems with alcohol, with Percocet, with heroin, with cocaine, amphetamines, things like that, prescription anxiety medications. That's where our primary focus is. We don't do other kinds of behavioral addictions like sexual addiction and things like that.
Right. Understand. Okay. And chemical addiction. Now, is food and overeating, is that a chemical addiction or is that more a habit?
No, it's absolutely a chemical addiction.
It is.
Happens with any addiction, and this is true of the behavioral addictions, and this is true of chemical addictions as well. And it is a little bit difficult to separate the two. And in fact, the separation is really somewhat artificial.
Okay.
You have in your brain a little piece of area that is frequently referred to as the reptilian brain, and that's because as we've evolved on this planet, the brains of more advanced animals have become bigger and bigger and bigger. While the simplest brain is really of land animals is really that brain that belongs to the reptiles, because reptiles simply need to know, is it going to kill me? Do I have to kill it? Can I eat it? Or can I have sex with it?
Right.
And so if it doesn't, and anything besides that, I mean, you don't see lizards sitting on the side of the road enjoying the sunset or smelling the roses. They don't need any of that information. So it's this reptilian brain, and in that reptilian brain, people talk about it as being a reward and pleasure area. But it really that cheapens the idea. It's not really about reward and pleasure, because if it really is about reward and pleasure, then people ought to be able to just stop doing what they're doing. But
right.
The reality is that this is really the survival part of your brain. The things that go on here help me to survive and allow me to survive. In fact, they're needed for survival. If I don't eat, I'm going to die. If I don't drink, I'm going to die.
Right.
If I don't breathe, I'm going to die. In fact, if I don't have sex, I'm going to die, right? So at least that's what I tell my wife all the time. You must know her, because she always laughs when I say that too. I'm going to die.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for my wife to finally understand.
But I won't die if that happens, or if it doesn't happen. But what will happen is if none of us have sex, then the species is gone. So that's why it's a survival mechanism.
Okay,
and
point.
What I tell people is when you're trying to, if you don't understand what an addiction is, here's the best way to do it.
Right.
I can guarantee you, I mean, I've got an engineering degree, I've got 4 years of medical school, I've got 4 years of residency, I've got 2 years of fellowship, and I now have 16 years of medical practice behind me. And with everything that is educated about me, I can guarantee you that anybody who would lay down on a table, on a floor, so they don't fall down, mm-hmm. and hold their breath until they passed out would have nothing bad happen to them. Nothing. Not a single thing. You won't skip a heartbeat. You won't lose brain cells. Nothing will happen. You'll be unconscious for just a few seconds. Many of us have kids. Many people have kids who have had breath-holding spells. None of my kids do, but one of my little sisters used to be able to do that. And they're unconscious for, you know, just a few seconds to maybe a minute or so. Then they wake up and life goes back on.
Huh.
Without any negative thinking. But I'll tell you, when you're holding your breath and the oxygen level starts to fall and the carbon
right.
dioxide level starts to go up and you just think, I can't do this anymore, I tell you, count to try to make it to 15. And what happens is that desire to breathe, I mean, you just got to go,
right.
take it in, because
right.
you feel like it doesn't matter what your brain knows in its knowledge base. You know that you're going to die if you don't take that breath. And that's the same compulsion.
Okay.
That people with addictions have. If I don't have just that one more thing, I'm going to die.
Hmm. But I bet at that moment of holding your breath, the extra drink or cigarette comes less to your mind than trying to breathe.
Well, at that particular time, and like I said, I mean, I don't usually have to explain to addicts what addiction's about, but
sure.
for people who don't have the addiction, you know, to say, great, now that you really want that breath, count to 15 and don't do it. It becomes almost impossible to do.
Huh, it's interesting.
And that's the
of course, we're going to have a lot of people trying that today. I might be one of them.
but that's the same kind of desire that happens when people have addictions. I got to do this, otherwise I feel like I'm going to die. So it's not about
wow.
reward and pleasure. I mean, it starts off as that, but it really isn't about reward and pleasure. Addiction is not a disease, and it's a disease in our survival part of the brain, and it's where I feel like I need to have this thing to survive. And whatever we need to survive are the things we're going to do.
Well, I didn't realize it was that strong. I always accused my wife of, well, in the past I accused her of being a chocolateaholic, but she seems to have kind of broken that, but coffee is definitely one of those.
Well, caffeine is certainly an addictive substance, and there's actually a chemical in chocolate called theobromine, and that is
okay.
also that also has some of that same kind, that also leads to some of that same behavior.
Which I think women have that gene that draws them more to chocolate than men do. But we won't get into that. We could get ourselves into trouble.
Yeah, they think if they don't have that chocolate, they're going to die. Well, we think it's sex, so.
That's right. But we're on the topic, so we don't forget, and I'll do it again at the end. There will be a few people that know somebody that friends of theirs do have some sort of addiction and need to get more help, or maybe they can convince them as part of their New Year resolutions. How do people reach you, and who are the right people to contact you?
Well, the best way to reach our office is to call us directly. We're in the phone book. And you can reach us anytime at 480-961-0014. Again, that's 480-961-0014. Our staff is on the phone all the time. Somebody is on the phone available 24 hours a day. When people really need help with addictions, we have a policy that we try to at all costs to try to get people within 24 or 48 hours. Simply because it's not okay to say, you know. So if you call and say, you know, I need a physical exam, well, we do primary care as well.
Right.
It will probably be 3 to 4 weeks before you can get in. But it's not okay for me to say, well, you know, can you just keep using that heroin now for the next 3 or 4 weeks? Well,
that's right.
Or if you could just stop for the next 3 or 4 weeks, because if they could stop for 3 weeks before they show up, then they really didn't need any help anyway.
No problem.
Yeah, so we get people in very quickly. We've had a little bit of trouble this last week just because the office has been closed a couple of days, and then we have people on vacation. But even now, we had somebody call over the weekend. He's coming in today. So we're actually quite good about getting people in, and you can do that anytime by calling our office, and somebody is either when the office is open, the office staff will answer the phone, and when it's not, then there is a line where you can reach the on-call provider anytime. And again, that number is, for anybody who needs it, is 480-961-0014.
Correct. And I have that in my records. If anybody does contact me, obviously we'll provide that as well. Now, since you're an expert on these addictions and chemical addictions specifically, I want to talk a few minutes on something that was on the Arizona ballot in November. Legalizing medical marijuana, specifically for people with medical use. And as I understand it, Arizona became the 15th state to allow the sale of marijuana for these medical purposes. The measure passed, but boy, was it close. As a matter of fact, I'd heard it didn't pass by about 3,000 votes, and then when they finally counted all the CHADs or whatever they do these days and all of the exact votes, it passed by just a very slim margin. But it did pass, so we are the 15th state to allow it. Now, at the time of the vote and prior to the vote, other than being listed in the booklet, I would say, from my own personal perspective, my own researching it, very little information, professional, real-type information was available on the pros and cons of having this go through. It's just the emotional, some people need it, and it's not available, and, we should allow them. But, you know, the risks and, we all kind of grew up, and at least the time I grew up, marijuana was like, you know, the beginning of the end of the world. And don't ever touch it, don't go near it, because it could, really attack you and jump out and get you. And at the other hand, when you travel, you realize countries like Holland have legalized it. But anyway, tell us your professional view on that ballot measure and the whole notion of having marijuana available to some portion of our population.
Sure. The first thing is when we classify in the United States medications or drugs, legal or illegal, as everything has a classification, and if there's any potential for them to have addiction, to be present in an addictive disorder, then they are all what we call schedule, and there's schedule 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And Schedule 1 drugs are the drugs that say, you know what, there is no way, this has no medical benefit, and it should never, and it's actually illegal to prescribe. There are some small ways around it that that you can do research with things, but otherwise you really cannot, it's illegal to prescribe. And that's what marijuana is, unlike a medication like Percocet or OxyContin, which is a Schedule 2 that says, yes, there is a high addictive potential, but there is significant benefit from it. And so it's Schedule 2, and then it can be prescribed. By the way, cocaine is a Schedule 2 drug. It can be prescribed.
Wow.
Most people don't know that. Now, you won't go to your doctor and get a prescription for it. And it's not even used very much anymore, but the place where it is used primarily is in people when they're having nasal or eye. Historically, it was used for eye surgery as well, but mostly now, few times it's used, it's either used in nasal surgery, or the other time we use it is to treat the wounds on little kids. And here's why. Of all of the Cocaine, in addition to its other effects that cause addiction problems, it's also an anesthetic agent. It doesn't work generally, but it works topically. And so if you are going to do nasal surgery on somebody, or if I have a young child, because if they come in and I give them a shot of lidocaine to numb that wound up before I sew it up, it really stings. And then these little kids don't want you touching them anymore, because you just, number one, poked them with a needle, and number two, squirted something in that burned the heck out of them. So sometimes we'll put a little topical cocaine on the wound. It doesn't get any significant systemic absorption, but it does two things. Number one, it numbs up the edges of the wound, and number two, it also, and both in nasal surgery, and nasal surgery, by the way, are really can be really bloody. It constricts the blood vessels, and so. You can use it in those two settings. Now, there are good alternatives now. We don't use it very much in the emergency room. There's a couple other alternatives that we use for kids. And again, there's newer alternatives, and so it's not used very much even in nasal surgery. But even a drug like cocaine is scheduled too, and there's been shown to be significant medical benefits. Marijuana actually has a fair amount of medical research out there where they talk about it being beneficial. In fact, there is if you want to say, there's a lot of people, particularly a lot of people on the anti-marijuana side, say, oh, there's already a legal drug out there that you can prescribe a prescription medication that's just like marijuana. The problem is it's called Marinol. It's used for people who have nausea, serious nausea. And the problem is it's not just like marijuana. It's part of what's in marijuana, but it's not just like smoking the plant. When you use marijuana, there are a number of chemicals that are actually active in the process of for the different benefits that medical marijuana can have. There are a number of different things, and the prescription Marinol really only has one of those. And so it can be very effective, and it can be effective when other anti-nausea medications aren't. But it's not as for many people, it's not as effective as marijuana. But there is great research on marijuana, and there are clearly some significant benefits for some people. Now, for everything that I'm aware of, there are certainly medical alternatives. And so medical marijuana should never be, and according to law, it's not supposed to be a first-line therapy. This is going to be used when other things that you've used let's say you have HIV or cancer and you're just wasting away. You're not eating. You're not hungry. Every time you put something in your mouth, you just feel sick. Marijuana is great, and you've tried all kinds of other things. Marijuana is a great drug to do two things. Number one, calm down the nausea. And number two, stimulate your appetite. I mean, for people who have smoked it or know of somebody who smoked it, they'll frequently hear about people getting the munchies. And so it actually can stimulate appetite and control nausea. In fact, there was a medication that's available outside the United States. It's probably not going to be available in the United States after its initial trial through the FDA. But it blocks one of the marijuana receptors. And by doing that, so if you smoke pot, you get the munchies. By blocking this receptor, you actually don't feel hungry, and it's been used for weight loss in other countries. So,
boy, I got to counter everything that you take. And it's interesting. But with this Schedule 1, so basically it moves from, with this law, it changes from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2. Is that how the change takes place, or just now is legalized and still is considered a Schedule 1?
It remains a Schedule 1, and that's really the problem.
Oh, okay.
So in California, so actually this is not the first time we've passed an initiative. This is an initiative for medical marijuana. I think this is the fourth one.
I didn't know that.
I think it's the fourth one that's come to a vote in Arizona. It's passed before, but the problem is that if you are a physician and you go to the Arizona Board of Medical Examiners, who give us our license, they say that we have to prescribe by federal law. And federal law still counts it as a Schedule 1. And so up until now, they've said it doesn't matter if it's legal in this state if you prescribe it. It's illegal according to the federal law, and therefore we're going to take your license away. Now, it's going to be interesting to see, because this law was written slightly differently. In theory, this is not going to be the same issue, because we don't really prescribe it. It's not going to be a prescription drug. It's going to be a dispense drug. And so the rules are going to be somewhat different. So it'll be interesting to see. But it remains a Schedule 1, which means so if the federal government decided that they wanted to come into one of these dispensaries and shut them down, they can under federal law, because whichever the general theory is that if a state and the federal government have laws that affect the same thing. The stricter one is the one that's enforcement. Is the one that's enforced. And in this case, it's the federal law that's enforced.
Gotcha. Okay, we've got, as real estate investors, we have a similar dilemma because under federal housing statutes, drug use and the possession are still illegal. So it'll be interesting if we have a medical marijuana patient who is a renter. We have a real legal dilemma. But anyway, that's a whole different topic. Let me jump one step further, which is I'm a finance guy, and my specialty is kind of helping people understand when you do certain things what effect it has on your personal finances. If I take just that narrow perspective of financial, I would say that we shouldn't have been looking at making medical marijuana legal, but actually legalizing marijuana. When I look back, I say prohibition was a failure. We spent billions and tens of billions, and somewhere I think around $43 billion on stopping marijuana and other drugs at the borders and growing it domestically. If it were legalized, we could control the quality. I mentioned before Holland has been, has legalized it, and it doesn't seem to have any major negative consequences. I haven't seen them fall off the map. As a matter of fact, they haven't shared in the same deep recession the U.S. has, and maybe that has little to do with the marijuana, but other than maybe people care less than we do that when we're in financial straits. Also, if it were legal, then there'd be less inclination to go out and get some of the harder drugs, the serious drugs, or the, well, let's call them harder drugs. I won't try to discuss the effects of chemical dependency or anything else with an expert. I'd rather ask you. But, you know, that narrow perspective says financially legalizing marijuana would make a lot of sense. It would reverse the cost of billions into an income of billions. What are your views from your knowledge of the addiction side of things?
Well, the first thing is that certainly within the realm of how the law is probably going to be implemented in Arizona. Nobody knows yet. The rules haven't been regulated. The rules haven't been completely written yet. But because it is going to not be a prescription medication, one advantage that potentially has for the state is prescription medications cannot be taxed.
Okay.
But because marijuana will not be a prescription medication, there is going to be probably a tax on marijuana. And so, again, that brings in revenue for the state. And certainly in an economically hard time, even people who say that you shouldn't raise taxes are not going to, you know, bat much of an eye about saying, yeah, but we're going to charge people who are smoking pot.
Sure, and also the office space that these dispensaries are going to open up already has a little bit of economic impact. So, yeah, it is a little step in that direction financially. There's no doubt about it.
Right. So there is that, certainly that point of it. Here's what I tell patients, and on a regular basis, actually, even before this came, even before the vote, people would come to me and say, well, what do you think about this? Or I have a few patients who have gone to California and get prescriptions, medical marijuana through California prior to it passing here and becoming available here. Although, as of right now, even though we, of course, passed the law some time ago, and it's supposed to go into effect in January, the rules have not been written, and there are no open. There are no new open dispensaries under this rule. There is one dispensary that's been opened under the old rules in Tucson, and they've never had problems, and they've done actually fairly well. So it is available in Arizona, and it's been available for some time. But under the new regulations, none of the new dispensaries have been open yet. When people ask me about marijuana, here's what I tell them: you don't have marijuana. People say, oh, what about the marijuana receptor? You don't have a marijuana receptor. God did not put marijuana receptors in our brain knowing that someday we would go out and smoke pot and say, oh, yeah. So that way when they find that, they'll have these little things. Everything that we use, every medication that we use, if it binds to something in our body, it's because it looks like something that we're already doing. Right, and marijuana receptors, which the natural chemical that we use is called anandamide, and so there's an anandamide 1 and anandamide 2. There's several anandamide receptors, and when you bind to these anandamide receptors, they're really novelty receptors. They're the things that make everything look interesting. Like, oh my God, look at that! All of my fingerprints really are different, and look, all of the bubbles in the tub have those nice shiny rainbows in it. And it really stimulates novelty. And like it or not, I mean, our brains are novelty-seeking machines.
Mm-hmm.
We are constantly looking for something new. out there. And so when you stimulate these things, everything seems really interesting and really exciting. And that's where I see as for marijuana, that's where the real problem is. I think that it can have some very good medical benefits, but the problem comes in the following. If you have anybody out there who's a pilot listening to this show right now,
right,
they've been through flight simulators before. So if I put them through a flight simulator, but I can do this with any cognitive behavioral, any thinking test, any test of hand-eye coordination. We're going to use flight simulators for now.
Sure.
Because I know the research has been done with this. And you put professional pilots in these flight simulators, they fly planes in these flight simulators very well, which is great, right? Because I want to make sure that when I get on a plane next time that somebody knows how to do this. If, on the other hand, after you do that, you give them a certain amount of alcohol, enough to get them intoxicated, and
mm-hmm.
then you put them back in the plane, in these flight simulators, they don't do as well. And when you
right.
ask them, they say,
right.
well, how did you do? They say, I didn't do very well. So, number one, they don't yep. do that well, and number two, they know they didn't do that well. Right?
Sure.
It's and then driving. You put them back in 24 hours later, and they get back in, and they do just as well as they did before they had a drink. Right. With
correct.
Marijuana, on the other hand, you put them in, they do well. You give them a drink, you give them a joint to smoke. They smoke, and they don't do very well when they're flying. Here's the interesting rub, though, and
okay.
that is most of them think they did pretty well. Most of them will say, you know, I don't
uh-huh.
think I did quite as well as I did before I had smoked, but I think I did pretty well. And it turns out that they typically do just as badly as when they're full of alcohol.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because everything seems more alive, more interactive, and because it seems to hold my interest. If it's holding my interest, I feel like I'm doing better with it. I feel like
okay.
I'm interacting
all
more
right.
with it, and
good,
even though
good,
I'm not.
Good
so,
analogy.
So with marijuana, you get impaired, and you're not aware of how impaired you are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the last thing that I tell people, and that is you bring those pilots back 24 hours later. And they have, and even though they are not experiencing any outward symptoms of marijuana, they still
right.
don't do as well 24 hours later in their flight simulator as they did before they had something to smoke.
Okay, so your awareness is dampened, and secondly, it is longer lasting, basically, or it stays. Its half life is a lot longer.
Its half life is much longer, and its effects are longer. So I do think, and I know that, I mean, because I've already written letters like this for other patients before to say, you know, based on what we've done, based on your disease, based on here are the 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 treatments we've already tried.
Right.
These things have not worked. Based on that, yes, you are a candidate for medical marijuana. I've written those letters before, and I'm sure that I'll write them again in the future. And
right.
I actually know people are going to be coming into the office once these dispensaries open and asking for that. And I think that there are people out there who I think it can really benefit, but I think you have to use it with real caution because
gotcha.
Unlike even if somebody has chronic pain, so we have a lot of people who have chronic pain, they're taking their pain medications on a regular basis, but even people like that, what we know is that over time, I mean, so if I don't take
yes,
pain
right.
medications for any reason, if I took 2 Percocet, I should not be getting in my car and driving right now.
Right,
but
right,
my
right,
patients,
right.
but patients who are taking medication over time develop a tolerance to that and can
correct.
Be just as effective in driving when they're taking their medication as somebody who's not. We don't know that that's true with marijuana. And in fact, it appears not to be true with marijuana.
Right.
And then the other thing is marijuana can be really hard to quit because when it's time to stop, you just get bored out of your mind because all of those novelty-seeking genes that have been so overstimulated now are used to this really high level of stimulation, and you are just bored as all heck. It's kind of like one day driving over the Rocky
mm-hmm.
Mountains and then the next day driving through the panhandle of Oklahoma and Texas. I mean,
right.
you go from these beautiful, gorgeous mountains to just being as flat, as the dry and flat as the eye can see. And, you know, you just think, where'd all the mountains go? Where'd all this interesting stuff go? Not that that flatness can't be beautiful. I don't want to pick up any listeners from
sure,
Oklahoma.
Sure, sure. No.
I'm not picking on that.
We're not picking on Oklahoma here.
Yeah, I don't want anybody calling up and telling me, oh, no, it's beautiful. Because I'm a desert guy, and I really like the desert. But it really is different. And so people just get bored, and they think, okay, well, if I just have a couple more hits, then I can kind of stimulate myself, and I'll get through this. And it becomes really difficult to quit. So I think that it does have a legitimate medical use. I think that the way the law is written in California, is too broad, and it is overused. Our law is certainly much more restrictive than California, which is good. New Mexico has even a more restrictive law. They actually have a very good law in the way theirs is written. So I think our law is certainly better than California's. I don't think we're going to run into many of the same problems. But the biggest problem is that as soon as you start just prescribing or dispensing something, it becomes available. And many
right.
people then, so, you know, so
yep.
we Body. See lots of Secondhand. Kids who are taking grandma's and grandpa's OxyContin. Why? Because
yep.
grandma and grandpa don't need to lock it up because they know they're not abusing it. But Johnny comes over and goes into the medicine cabinet, and, you know, grandma and grandpa don't notice one or two
yep.
pills gone.
Yep.
So that's the problem is how do people take care of it when they leave? Number one is who is it being dispensed to, and are we dispensing appropriately? And like I said, in California many times it's, you know, you walk in, you say, I have this, and then you get a prescription. And I don't think that's okay. But on the other thing is how will it be taken care of? Is it going to be just sitting out there? So not only if it's dispensed to me, my kids have access to it, or do I have it in a lockbox so that nobody else has access to it and it's really being used legitimately? And so certainly, as medical marijuana begins to be dispensed here, I can guarantee you that the rates of marijuana addiction problems will go up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about if there's more availability. Now, is that a good reason to not make it available to those people who would benefit from it? I don't think so. I mean, what we just have to do is we have to try to educate our clients to say, look, if you want it to be available, this is what you need to do.
Yep.
A lot of methadone treatment programs, for example, if you get a take-home dose, you don't get your take-home dose unless you come in with a lockbox. So it goes right into a lockbox. So we, you know,
gotcha.
I think that would be a great thing, a great thing for the marijuana dispensaries to say, we will not dispense it to you unless you have a lockbox, and we want you to put it in your lockbox so that we know when you go home, it's there, it's locked up, it keeps it safe from your kids, your grandkids, your neighbors, your friends, your wife, your spouse to get into it.
Right, and your car trunk does not qualify as a lockbox. I understand.
Right.
Okay. How about one quick question on that? If you compare alcohol and marijuana in terms of the chemical addiction capability or level of risk, are they similar, or is one worse than the other?
They really are similar.
Okay.
The big thing is that if somebody quits using alcohol, then alcohol can be more life life threatening when people quit. So if you try to stop smoking marijuana, you can certainly have this sensation that, you know, God, everything just is boring. I'm bored out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's flat. We call it anhedonia. With alcohol, however, you can start having seizures. You can have significant medical problems, and that can lead to including with delirium and seizures, which both of which can lead to death. So.
Okay.
From a withdrawal perspective, alcohol is much worse. From an intoxication perspective, they're about equal. Like I said, with the big difference being that with marijuana, you tend to not understand how intoxicated you
exactly.
actually are.
Is that awareness of it? Yep. Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Very, very interesting. Okay. Let's switch now to the main topic of our show, which is helping people build their wealth. As I mentioned in the intro, one of the biggest impediments to becoming wealthy is desire, that people say they want to be, but they really are kind of addicted to poverty, as you introduced that topic to me. Tell us a little bit about this addiction to poverty and kind of contrast it to this whole substance abuse and how you came up with this topic.
All right, so with addiction to poverty, with poverty, I think a couple things are important. That is, like with addiction to any chemical substance, I think that there are genes that predispose us to certain kinds of behavior. And as I said, if I've inherited the genetics for something, you know, my great-great-grandfather was an alcoholic, my grandfather was an alcoholic, my great-grandfather was an alcoholic, and my mother's an alcoholic. So if I run into trouble with it, it shouldn't be surprising, right? Because those
right.
genes have been passed down from generation to generation to generation. So there is certainly genetics. But the second part is, as I alluded to earlier, those genes can be turned on or they can be turned off. And I think that what happens with certain behaviors is they become certainly inherited with any kind of addictive behavior. Roughly half of my risk is my genetics, and the other half is my environment. Now, So if people say, well, if half of it's environment, why, I got a 50% chance of being able to control it. The problem is that a lot of my environment is not under my control.
Right.
All right, so I need to go this morning to my office. I have no control on what happens between my house and my office in traffic. That's not in my control.
Right.
I have no, you know, so there's lots of the things that occur in my environment that are beyond my control. In fact, typically you only have significant influence on about 30% of your environment. So you don't have the influence over your genes, right? You don't get to pick who your parents were. Or if you do, you did it a long time ago. You did it before this lifetime, for those people who believe that. You did it before this lifetime, and you're still stuck with whatever genes they pass on to you.
That's right.
All right? And you really only have influence on about 30% of the environment that you can do. And so that means you only have influence over about 30% of this
half,
whole
right.
thing that creates that. There's an old saying, which actually is very true. People have done some scientific research with this. I was just reading about this a couple weeks ago, where they say that if you've lived with somebody for a long time, particularly if you've been married to somebody for a long time, that you start to look like your spouse. And I've heard that data before, and I've heard it for a long time in one of the Disney movies, 101 Dalmatians, the old cartoon version of it. They actually kind of do a play on it where people look like their dogs. And they kind of show the faces of people and the faces of their dogs and how they look the same. But the reason that this can happen in people is because we have a group of neurons in our brain called mimic neurons, and they help us mimic okay. behavior. So if you and I are interviewing, and I'm interviewing mm-hmm. for a job with you, one of the things that I do, or one of the things I do
right.
when I'm interviewing my patients, is you kind of mirror what they do.
Right, right, right.
If they're smiling, you smile. If they're kind of leaning back, you lean back. And what that does is it builds rapport between the two of you. Well,
right.
the same thing happens with facial behaviors, facial movements. And so if one spouse is more likely to smile, the other one is going to be more likely to smile. One spouse is more likely to frown, the other one's more likely to frown. And after a while, just like working out in the gym, if I do, you know, my weights every day, I'll get some nice big biceps. If I use my smile muscles or not use my smile muscles on
gotcha.
A regular basis, my face starts to take on some of that same appearance that this other person does. If you want to know how much you weigh, how much you're going to weigh 5 years from now, what you should do is look at the 10 or 15, 20 people around you, find out
right.
what their weight is, and I can tell you that if most of your friends are overweight, you're going to be overweight. Even if you're not overweight now, if most
right.
of your friends are underweight, then you're going to maintain a better body weight. We tend to do things that are in keeping with our environment. So it really is important that this goes deeper than just, oh, I tried using alcohol and so now I can stop. Or, Daddy, if you really love me, you can stop drinking. Or, honey, if you're really serious about maintaining this marriage, you can stop. It really isn't that simple. And poverty is no different. Poverty
okay.
is absolutely not different at all. We are in an environment, and most of us were born into some environment. You know, some of us were born into poverty, some of us were born into wealth, and some people were born into the middle class. And it turns out that if you look at that, most people who are born into poverty stay in poverty. Most people who are born into the middle class stay in the middle class, and most people who are born into wealth mm-hmm. stay into wealth. Now, certainly, there are people who can get out of that, and we love to tell stories about somebody who had nothing and rose to be, you know, this multimillionaire. But if
exactly.
you look at that, there's just not very many people who do it. We like to hold that out as the example, but it's just not very many people who do that. And so, and a lot of it has to do with who are the people who are around me. The interesting thing is if you listen to the stories of most of those people, is they somehow found a way to ignore the people around them and to put themselves
gotcha.
In a position where they had someone else there. Whether it was an actuality, so I had a mentor who would spend time with me,
mm-hmm.
or it's because I, you know, read about Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or Robert Kiyosaki or, you know, these people and started to behave like them. And so
right.
what it really is about is what do we have to do to change our behavior, but getting away from the things that we're used to is really hard. A lot of people say, you know, when I do this, it's like, oh, yeah, how come, you know, even my addiction patients say, look, I've cut off all contact with these people who I were using from, who well, how do you do that? Well, you know, I've done this and I've done that. And then how successful have you been? Well, they still call me. And then how? Where does that put you? You know, and how come you're moving away from us? Don't you like us anymore? And so then they kind of put this guilt trip on you. And certainly
Correct.
People will do that. People will say, oh, what's wrong? My house isn't good enough for you. You know, where you come from isn't good enough for you. You have to move out of the projects into the suburbs. What happened? Are you too good for this? And that really puts then a guilt trip on people in terms of preventing them from moving outside of the realms of their comfort.
Correct. And, well, I think the lottery is the one that's often cited, and people, you know, people that become millionaires in the lottery end up losing it again. Not that they gave it away all to charity and liked that style of life. It's just that they don't know how to manage it, and everybody around them is convincing them that's a bad idea. They didn't deserve it. So what you're really saying is our environment, our friends, our family, the things we grew up with stick with us.
Absolutely. So the very first thing you have to do when you have any kind of addiction, and that can, again, whether it's alcohol or cocaine, or whether it's I am determined to change my wealth level. I am determined
right.
to get out of poverty. I am determined to get out of being in lower middle class status.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of what that is, you number one have to have a goal. You need to have it. And one of the studies that I like to talk about here is, and because not only do you have to have a goal, but you really want to write that goal down. And that was, there's a study out of Harvard, and they looked at the Harvard MBA program, and they looked at the people who graduated, I believe it was 1978, and they asked them, do you have goals? For financial goals for your future, and 70% of the people said no, 30% of the people said yes. And of the 30% of the people who said yes, most of them, only a total of about 3% had written their goals down. The other
right.
27% had not written their goals down. They looked at them 10 years later, and they found that the group of people who had goals, financial goals, were making twice as much as the people who had not had financial goals. But the people who had financial goals and wrote them down were making 10 times as much as everybody else.
Wow.
So yep. putting your goal, so number one, figuring out what your goal is, and number two, putting it to writing really makes things very, very, very different. When you write it down, it commits it in a structurally in your brain in a way that just thinking about it doesn't. So it really is important to try to say, what are your goals, and write them down.
Okay.
Once that's done, then it's important to say, great, how do I get to where I'm going, where I want to be? Now, I take a little. This is the one place where I think I take a little bit. The general approach is still really important. I just usually don't ask my addicts where they want to be in 10 years because most of them can't see beyond the next week because they're coming off of stuff. They're sick. They're tied up.
Sure.
In this. But I like to, when I'm talking to people financially. Where do you want to be, and pick a longer-term goal. Now,
sure.
for people who really are good at planning, great, pick 10 years out. If you're not so good, pick 5 years out. If you're not so good, pick 3 years out. If it's not so good, where do you want to be in 1 year?
Right.
In 3 years. And then with that, then say, okay, now let's start working backwards to say, okay, this is where I want to be 3 years from now. Where do I have to be 2 years from now? If that's where I want to be 2 years from now, how do I get? Where do I have to be a year from now? And start working backwards until you have, say, okay, so what I need to do today is... and then go out and do it. So every day I know what I have to do in order to make that become a reality. And I think that when you do that, it really changes the way the brain works. One of the things that's interesting, we talked earlier about the limbic part of the brain and how that's involved with these survival instincts. And it's also really the emotional part of our brain. And that is, if the emotion is strong enough, and by the way, the frontal parts of our brain, the frontal lobes, are where we're really what sets us apart from all the other animals in the whole world, where we have this really huge thinking capacity that and reasoning capacity that other animals don't have nearly as much of. But if the emotional part of my brain gets triggered, it controls the blood flow. So it can shut the blood flow down to the thinking, reasoning parts of my brain. So when I get into these tight settings, when I get into these settings where, okay, now it's time for me to, you know, put up or shut up, I've got to make this decision now. Frequently, these emotional aspects of it lead me to relapse back into my addiction or my poverty way of thinking. It keeps me from moving on into this new into this new way of thinking, and then I failed. And once I failed, and now not only do I have my friends saying, hey, aren't you good enough for us? Now I think, well, maybe that was just a silly idea anyway. Maybe they were right. Because the more you succeed, the easier it is to find success. And the more you fail, the easier it is to kind of line up and do things, right?
Absolutely.
If what restaurant becomes my favorite is based on how many times I went there. The more I go there, the more likely that is going to be one of my favorite restaurants, and the more I'm going to go back, which is why in sales, you know, we always try to say, who do we really want to sell to? Yeah, we'd like to bring in new customers, but who's the easiest person to sell to?
Sure.
Somebody that I've already
Absolutely.
Sold to, right? I've already built the relationship. They've gone there once with me. They're going to go there twice with me. Now that they've gone 10 times with me to this sale, they're going to go the 11th time, and each time it becomes easier and easier and easier for that to happen. That's true with the success, but it's also true with the failures.
Gotcha. All right, and so it really is the old habit notion. I guess we call it kicking the habit and those kinds of things, but it really is what I've been doing. So if for 30 or 40 years I've been spending everything I earn, that cycle is going to continue for the next year.
It is. It's difficult to break that. But you know, and I don't like the word habit. And the most of the reason I don't like the word habit is because there's these books out there that say, "Oh, change your habits in 21 days."
Right,
you can't
do
it. You can't even get. Again, with addiction, here's a classic example.
Sure.
We have 28-day programs where people will go, and sometimes they'll spend you know $5,000-$6,000. And some of these programs, you can walk in. I know of a program in California where to be there for a month, you're going to have to drop $120,000 cash.
Ouch.
And you will learn a lot of things in these programs. They're great. But you learn them in an environment that's completely away from where you normally function. And then on a regular basis, people go back, and just within sometimes hours, much less days or weeks, they're back to the same behavior. A funny research study that was done. They took a bunch of college kids, and they gave them I think it was a six-week math course. Half the kids learned in the classroom. And at the end of this 6 weeks, they gave them a test, and, you know, the kids did pretty well because they learned it. The other half of the kids, however, they taught them while they were underwater breathing scuba gear. And at the end of that 6 weeks, they gave them a test. And it turned out that these kids did essentially just as well as the kids who had learned in the classroom. So that wasn't that interesting. But, I mean, it was people would think that, okay, it's a little harder to do that, so maybe they'll be more distracted. But they did about the same, which was interesting. But here's the fun part. What they did then was take the kids who had learned it in class, gave them the test while they were underwater breathing scuba equipment, and these kids did worse. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because now I've got all these new distractions of what I'm doing.
Yep.
Then they took the kids who had learned it underwater, and they gave it to them in a classroom and said, wow, I'm taking all these distractions away. These guys should really do well. They actually did worse as well. Why? Because when I learned things, I don't have little pieces of information in my brain that are completely devoid of association with anything else in the world. Everything that I know, everything that I've learned is in there in association with something else. And so when I take myself out of that situation where I learned it, it becomes much more difficult to apply that knowledge in this new setting. So we take people who go on these 28-day treatment programs, they go home, and all of a sudden, you know, their spouse is there, and now I have some of those same negative interactions with my spouse, which I didn't have for the 28 days while I was in this other program, and I start falling back into the same behaviors, right?
Wow.
Or,
back to the environment.
You know, I go to the bank, and or I go to the grocery store, and I start falling into these same behaviors of buying foods that I don't need. Buying that new TV, even though I've got three in my house and there's only two people there, I got to have that one more TV. You know, I got to upgrade my computer this one more time. I'm just spending my money because that's what I'm used to doing, even though I've kind of made this commitment. So, absolutely. So the first thing is setting that goal and writing it down, and then the second thing is really trying to work on changing that behavior. But it's not just habit, because like I said, I don't like the word habit because there's.
Sure.
You know, 7 days to change your habit, 21 days, you can change your habits in 30 days. It's not that simple. It's not that simple.
So you're in changing the behavior, also changing that environment. So the guy that did move out of the projects to the suburbs has a better chance of getting out of that addiction to poverty than somebody that stays there and talks about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So someone who, in fact, I was talking to somebody the other day, and he lost his job. And I said, so what are you doing? He says, I'm going to work every day. I said, what? He says, I'm going to work every day. He says,
right.
I'm not going to make any money at home. I'm going to go to work every day until that person realizes that I am the one for that job. You know, so having him kind of pull back and say, well, gosh, poor me. Oh, yeah, the, you know, the unemployment rate is 9.9%, and, you know, there's no way I'm going to get a job, and the economy's bad, and it's not really my fault, but, you know, it's just kind of the way things are. He's not willing to bend into that. He's willing to stay in the system where he was generating his wealth.
Yep.
And so by staying in that system and not leaving that system, he is much more likely to find a track. Now, it may not be with that company, but just kind of staying in that system without kind of backing off and saying, okay, well, I guess we're going to write this one off. Staying in that system where this is where I made my wealth, this is what I'm going to do next. Now, by the same token, many of us have kind of gone down a road, and, you know, so we maybe have had some success with this once or twice, but then we meet multiple times with failure. Maybe that's a sign that maybe that isn't the right way for me to join it. It doesn't mean I should quit, but if I'm going to do it, then I want to say, where do I need to go? What do I want to do? How do I change my environment? How do I change this environment so that not only am I getting away from the things that I've done wrong in the past or done incorrectly in the past, but how do I do it to maximize that effect? And again, the best way to do it is by being around people who are looking to maximize that effect. It's really
correct.
Difficult to do on your own.
And if you can't, then the role model piece of it is something else you touched on, is to have that role model and really understand them, even though you can't meet them and maybe spend time with them, is get to know the things that makes them different.
Right.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, this is obviously the front part of our discussion here. It was, I'm sure our listeners said, wow, this guy knows a lot about addictions, and there's no doubt about it. You are one of the experts. Now, one of the things we'll be wrapping up here shortly, one of the things I want to make sure we have is repeat your contact information. So let me get your phone number back out to these people. It's 480-961-0014. And just in case you didn't get that hint, don't call necessarily to get your prescription for marijuana, nor for cocaine, even though it's been used medically, doesn't mean that Dr. Carlton is going to recommend that you can start using cocaine for your daily use. So that's not why you call. It's if you do know somebody with addiction problems and seeking help. So that'd be a great person to contact. Really, really appreciate your time, insights. I've taken some notes on these steps, and it really kind of gets me into a couple of the closing comments I was going to make on goals. Before I do that, let me just remind our listeners that we're going to have our next live seminar, Learn to Earn a Higher Return, on Tuesday, January 11th at 10:15 a.m., and that's at NTrust Arizona's Knowledge Center in North Phoenix. If you'd like to be on our list to make sure you know about future shows and events, my email is ron@theronald.us. Also, we're still early in the Christmas season, so I'd like to wish each and every one of you a very Merry Christmas. And maybe the next 9 days of this Christmas season will be a great time to spend on your goals. And we talked about it, and hopefully you're writing down your resolutions and your goals for the new year and your goals beyond the new year. You got a little bit better flavor from Dr. Carlton's discussion on writing them down. So whether your goals are to break addictions, drugs, alcohol, coffee, or it's poverty, unemployment, or maybe smoking or overeating, then let's start with writing down those goals and using this time to set those in motion, get you out of the old environment, and start changing your behavior, modeling after those people you want to be like, not spending more time with the people that you don't want to be like. Now, what is a goal? We didn't define that. Let me just give you my very brief definition. It's a dream with a deadline. Yep, you've got to have a deadline. You've got to know what it's about. And we often talk about goals as SMART goals. Maybe that'd be a good topic for January. I hadn't thought of that earlier. But SMART goals are a way to kind of write it down, be much more specific, and make sure that you're focused. You're not just setting a date, but exactly how I'm going to accomplish it. And I'd like to thank Dr. Carlton for joining us today, number one. And I'd like to close by wishing each of you what I shared with a number of people in our audience and friends, my Christmas wish and New Year's wish for you, and that is that you be truly thankful for yesterday, since it made you who you are today, that you live today as if there were no tomorrow, and that you plan for the future as if the world depended on what you accomplish. I look forward to seeing all of you next year on your way to breaking your addictions, that includes poverty, and becoming truly wealthy. And many thanks to Dr. Carlton for joining us today. Thanks a lot, and have a great, great Christmas and New Year.
You've been listening to Wealth DNA with the Ronald, Ron Naraki. Wealth DNA is a Boomer and the Babe Enterprises radio production. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.